If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
Become a farmer instead of a hunter, right? I think I've heard somebody say that before, right? But real estate is a relationship business, and anybody that tells you otherwise is bullshitting you, right?
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Serge Shukat, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Hey, man, the pleasure's all mine. If you don't mind, just give our listeners a quick bio on who you are.
You know, my story's out there if anyone wants more detail, but I am a multifamily investor, former corporate guy, came from the corporate world in the mid-2000s, showing my age a little bit. I'm started investing in Arizona real estate via SID, the single family home space. Grew that business slowly but surely over the next 5 years between 2008 to 2013. And around that time frame, started trading up from selling out on the single family and into the multifamily space.
Right,
that's
right.
High level view.
No, I love that. I love that. You picked a good time to start investing in single family, it seems.
Yeah, the writing was on the wall. It was, I was an accountant. So crunching the numbers came naturally. And at that time, the disparity between rental income and purchase price was as high as it could possibly be back then. On the bigger pockets, the rule was the 2% rule, right? That your income from your rent needed to equal 2% of your purchase price and you'd be fine, you know, and that was a very general rule. And we were doing deals with the 3% rule or the 4% rule. Although I don't abide by that rule, I'm still doing deals that are 2% rule in this market, which sounds crazy, but they're out there. The deals are still there.
Right, right. Now that is fascinating. You heard, at least, you know, I kind of heard the same thing when I came into real estate. It's the 2% rule. Well, now we're seeing the 1% rule or the 0.8% rule, and it just keeps getting narrower and narrower. Good for you for finding deals still that make sense, but you're not doing deals that make sense with the 2% rule in single family anymore.
No. The single family market's long gone, right? Seen in the past year since COVID, particularly in my net migration states like Arizona and North Carolina and South Carolina, Florida, you're seeing a doubling depending on what space, you know, is it the 100,000 to 200,000 range or is it the million plus? Kind of doesn't matter. Prices doubled. In the low end range, they're up 2.5. You're not finding anything. I mean, if you're investing in single family, you probably already had assets and maybe you're moving towards quality or a new market. But unless you're going to war zones in Toledo, which still exist, you're not finding those deals in the single family space anymore. And on top of that, you have Wall Street coming in, buying full communities. You've probably heard of that. You know, they're going to a Lennar or Toll Brothers and they're saying that when you finish this community of 100 homes, we'll buy all of it, right? And they're buying it to rent. And they're just seeing it as a good hedge to inflation, which really it is, right? And with interest rates so low, you can make these things pencil out at a 2-3% return as long as you pencil rent growth. And everybody's penciling rent growth right now. And that's really what's driving the market. Multifamily, single family, pretty much all real estate you're looking at right now. Industrial, you're seeing inflationary pressure, which is going to put pressure on prices. That simple.
Do you see any danger in this penciling in of rent growth that we're seeing?
You know what? Pre-pandemic, I thought the market was very frothy, which in retrospect was incorrect, but who would have predicted the pandemic, right? Today, I don't think so. I think that there is a lot of room for rent growth across the market with the money that has been injected into the economy. You can look at the precedent of 2008, 2009, and what that did, what asset bubble that created. And the money that went into the economy this time around was 5 to 6x higher, and they're still talking about it. So the inflationary pressure is just going to continue. We've seen it in pretty much every single sector. So I'm bullish. I'm bullish on very specific markets. I'm bullish on rent growth. I'm bullish on specific asset classes, and I continue to buy because of that. Whereas in 2009, pre-pandemic, I was preaching the opposite.
You were preaching the opposite? What do you mean by that?
I thought the market was certainly frothy. I thought it had been driven by the dual combination effect of the 2008-2009 stimulus still trickling through the economy 10 years later, which was starting to dwindle out, combined with the 2017 tax cuts, which were profound. And people don't talk about what that did for real estate, but that was the biggest bag of incentives to invest in real estate ever. And that continues to drive the market. And the proposed tax changes that are coming in our future are perhaps the biggest threat that we see to ending this party.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. When you talk about rent growth and you're bullish on rent growth, do you see buying power going down as rent growth? I mean, if we have inflation, right, and it's just a kind of a hot button topic right now, I mean, despite the rent growth, the actual purchasing power of the dollar would go down. Is that a fair analysis?
Correct. But remember, when you're buying real estate, particularly a sophisticated product like a large multifamily, when you're buying a 200-unit multifamily apartment complex for $25 million, right, you're underwriting that on discounted 10-year cash flows, 5-year cash flows, whatever your model is, right?
Right.
So you're paying today's value on the projected stream of income over the next 10 years, right? Right. So if you can underwrite rent growth of, say, 5%, it's generally, you know, what you can pay changes drastically. If you can underwrite 4% growth, your number is going to be, say, $20 million. If you underwrite 5% growth, your number can be $22 million. If you can underwrite 6% growth, your number can be $24 million. That's just an example, okay?
Sure.
So yes, your purchasing power has certainly been constrained today. But depending on what your prognosis is on rent growth, you can make the numbers work, right? And the numbers are very subject to manipulation today. Typical underwriting models 2 years ago, if somebody projected rent growth of more than 4% a year, you'd say they're crazy. You'd say they're being aggressive. You'd say they, or if they were projecting economic occupancy greater than 90%, or economic loss of greater than 10%, whichever way you want to look at it, you'd say that they were being aggressive. Right now, you can't get a deal if you underwrite it 15% economic loss.
Right.
You'll get outcompeted. So today, it's really important to understand what's going on around you. And it's really important to have an investment philosophy and stick by it, right? If you think that it's frothy, if you think that once the government stimulus runs dry, unemployment will shoot up, if you think inflationary pressure cannot be sustained, and if you think that rent can't continue to grow because incomes aren't going to keep pace, then this isn't the market for you, right? That's one position. That's not my position, but that's certainly a position that's to be respected and understood because there's a lot of validity. All of that can happen.
Right.
So it's really important to invest in the right asset first and foremost. The right asset is gonna lead you through this one way or another.
Right. And you have chosen multifamily as that right asset.
I believe so. And I'm not steady with multifamily. You know, I look at good real estate. I'll look at a hotel asset. I'll operate in a number of different ways. I want the best possible asset. I want rent growth. I want an undermanaged property. Right. Mm-hmm. So that I can underwrite not only rent growth and not only can I increase value through that rent growth, but through renovations, through already the property already being under market. Right. So I'm looking for velocity. I'm looking for $100. I'm the past management to be inefficient and leaving, call it $100 to $150. Then I'm looking at another $100, $150 in renovations and management efficiencies. Then I'm hoping for another $100, $150 in rent growth over the next 3 to 5 years. And what makes me different, right, is that I can wait it out, right? As long as my debt is advantageous and gives me long-term flexibility, if the market does stumble, I'll wait it out as long as my cash flow is there. So I'm working the cash flow backwards, right? I'm not going to invest in something that I got to do $2.5 million in renovations to then squeeze out a 5 cap post renovation and then hope to sell at a 4 cap, which is the model most syndicators back into. And it's been a valid model. I can't say anything bad about it because it's made a lot of people a lot of money. But I see a lot of risk in that model, right? I see a lot of risk in that model. I see the risk of exit cap rates? Are they going to continue to be 4 or 3.5? CapEx risk? Can I, CapEx and construction risk, can I execute on a $2.5 million CapEx? And some guys are better situated to do that than others. I don't have a construction company, right? I have crews that have been working with me for years and we've executed, but because I executed yesterday doesn't mean I can execute today. So at the end of the day, you're taking on all these risks, whereas as an individual investor that can underwrite clearly, I can sit back and wait for the one good deal, two, three, as many deals as I want to do a year. And I can do them, I can time them. So I'm never doing more than one or two at the same time, right? And I can mitigate all those risks. I can mitigate all those risks by buying the right asset, right? And sitting on it. Right. And it's worked for me.
Right. Right. Absolutely. You'd mentioned something earlier that you talked about the debt that you guys take on that allows you the flexibility to be patient and not worry about timing the market and just do what makes sense and what's prudent. What sort of debt terms do you guys what is the only debt terms that you guys will accept?
Well, you know, you take what's given to you. You know, if you got bad credit and you're not an operator and you've never done it before, you know, you're not going to have many options. So I work with two community local state lenders, portfolio lenders. I've also done Fannie and you know, GSA debt in the past. I prefer not to. I don't like the prepays, and there's ways around the prepays. But generally, I need flexibility on exit. I don't want my exit decision being driven by a large prepay or governmental restrictions on that debt. Right. So I have very flexible terms, and my rates maybe are maybe a quarter point higher than a Fannie or Freddie loan. But in a scenario where I'm doing a heavy lift, I'll get interest only for a year. It's 10-year fixed debt, 30-year amortization. It's in the mid threes right now, maybe mid to high threes. And the most important thing of it all is I'm getting this debt on a phone call, right? So these are balance sheet loans where at the end of the day, even if I'm doing a more risky transaction, right, that I'm going into a new field, like I did a hotel conversion, 168 unit, former Marriott residence in that I converted to a multifamily, and I had never done it before. So I had to convince the lender. And at the end of the day, the lender said, well, I don't know. I don't have financials. You're getting it empty. There's a whole lot of risk here, but it's a signature loan and you're putting your balance sheet on it, right? Mm. So being able to throw that balance sheet at these lenders allows me to do products to buy property that there's virtually no competition, right? Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of individual investors doing this stuff. And so I'm not trying to be a part of the herd. I'm not trying to do what everybody else is doing. I'm not trying to syndicate 150 unit with 20 investors. You know, nothing against that model. I love that model. I've done it. It's a great way to wealth. Nothing negative to say about it, but I don't want to compete. There's 20 other guys doing that. And I really believe when the merry-go-round ends, those operators are going to be the ones left holding the bag. Let's be honest. Somebody's going to be left holding the bag, right? Prices cannot continue to go up forever, right? And somebody at the end of the day is going to be left holding that bag, right? And I can't sit here and tell you it's not going to be me. It could be me left holding the bag. But you know what? My cash flow is going to be such that, right, that I'll sit through it. Same thing with the recession. The recession was fantastic for us. We made a lot of wealth in the recession. We made a lot of wealth during coronavirus. Our balance sheet doubled during coronavirus, right? So again, it had to do with being in the right asset and having the flexibility of sitting through it, not having investors that I promised a 15% IRR on, you know what I mean? And being able to have ultimate flexibility to go into asset classes that the herd isn't chasing.
Right.
And that's our competitive advantage. And if you can't articulate your competitive advantage, you're probably going to be the one left holding the bag.
I like that. No, and I think what you said here makes a lot of sense in that you guys, you know, and I guess just to clarify this, you guys basically, you fund all your own deals. Like you don't bring any other investors in with you on your projects. Like it's just you and what you decide to buy. Is that about right?
That is 100% correct. I did one syndication with who I consider the best syndicator in the business. And I learned a lot. And this was at a time when my portfolio was probably 10% of the size. And I was bird dogging it. You know, I was that syndicator's guy in Phoenix. I was looking at 200 unit properties. I was interviewing property managers. And you know what? We did a deal and we did it together and I co-sponsored it as a GP and it was successful and we exited and we hit our IRR and we exited 3.5, 4 years later. And you know what? I didn't make that much money, right, on it. I mean, it was okay, right? But the lessons I learned were invaluable. And it's what I teach my kids, right? The value is in the knowledge, not the money. It's not the money, it's in the knowledge. And what I learned from that was that I didn't want to be a syndicator, right? I learned that I got to do 10 deals for every one great deal I can do myself. So save up for that one great deal, do it yourself. I had the knowledge as a GP. I had the knowledge. I knew how to underwrite, right? And it gave me the foundation. It gave me the foundation to know, understand how it's done, what it's like to be a portfolio manager, what it's like to manage 10 multifamilies and to get questions answered. Like, how many multifamilies can one guy manage, right? As a portfolio manager? What is it like reporting to investors? What is it like to truly deliver a 15% IRR? People don't understand what that calculation looks like, right? When you promise your investors a preferred return of call it 8%, when you're buying multifamily at a in-place 3 cap, renovating it for $2 million, and then getting cash flow slowly increasing that operate that gross revenue from 100 to 120 over 2 years, I'll tell you right now, there's zero cash flow. There's no cash flow.
Right.
But you know what? That 7% preferred is still, you still owe it. So it's accruing and it's accruing. And so time is not on your side. So you can show great returns as a syndicator if you could exit in 12 months, in 20 months, in 24 months. And the pandemic and coronavirus gave a lot of these guys those outs, right? I think we were saved. This industry was saved by the coronavirus in essence, right? Because of the inflation and asset valuation. But that's not a general rule. And because it happened in the past doesn't mean it's going to happen again on future investments. And a lot of these limited partners that are investing think that this is now what their expectations are going to be. And I don't think it's going to be, because now you have more pressure on your preferred, right? They want either a higher preferred or the same preferred, but now you're paying more for the same asset and your rents haven't gone up that much to prefer, right, for the increase in purchase price, right? Combined with the expectations, hey, on the last one you exited in 24 months, let's do it again, right?
Right.
So God bless. Hopefully it continues, right? Hopefully it continues and everybody wins. But what history has taught us is it doesn't go up forever. It just doesn't, right? And so when the merry-go-round, when the musical chairs stop, who's the guy? Who's holding the bag? And I keep telling my peers, I don't want to be the guy holding the bag. And if I'm the guy holding the bag, I want them to be some damn quality assets that my kids would be proud to get, you know?
Right, right. And is that your long-term game plan then? Really, it's just to buy and hold in perpetuity?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. When I first started, you know, I would look at these single family homes. And, oh, I love this house. I'm going to keep it forever. And I'm going to, for my kids. And it's like, you know, I have two girls, one's 14 and one's 8, and they're growing and they show no interest in real estate, which is okay. You know, maybe one day they will. But what I realized is it's not for everybody. It's not for everybody. And these tax kind of discussions should be a wake-up call for a lot of people, right? It's not always going to be easy to pass on these assets to your heirs, right? And look at, go back and look at some high net worth guys that did pass on these assets to their heirs. How did that work out? Generally not well. Mm-hmm. Generally not well. Generally, these kids can't manage these assets. It takes a very special talent, right? Everybody looks from the side and says, oh, it's easy. That guy was lucky. That guy bought in 2008. He lucked out.
Right.
Bullshit. It's not about lucking out. It's about being in a position when the market changes to capitalize, right? The guy that lucked out, you don't see the 5 years he spent researching and agonizing and making mistakes and doing trial and error to be ready for the time, right? You don't see that. And so to project that on your kids, that they're going to follow in your footsteps and be as good as you are, sell out, pay your taxes, leave them the cash, right? And you know, I'm in my mid-40s, subjects to change every year, right? This changes every year. But no, I no longer have a long-term horizon. When I say long-term, 10, 20, 30 years on any asset, And that includes my single family. I look at them like cars. When I'm sick of them and they're a pain and they're a problem and they're a problem to manage, and I, you know, and I have 2x equity or the equity multiple, the return on equity doesn't make sense anymore, I don't care how much it's cash flowing. It's gone. I'm selling. I'm not beholden to these properties. And I'm a believer that you have to sell. You have to lock in your gain. And there is so much power in the velocity of selling. Right? You sell one asset and it's hard to sell. The first assets that I sold, I agonized. Am I leaving cash on the table? Right. Is it the right time to sell? Is this the right deal? Did this broker get over on me? Is this seller ripping me off asking for $100,000 concession? All of that. I don't do that anymore. I know that when I sell one, it's going to open up the doors to buy three. Right? Or to buy four. And I no longer agonize. Will there be these three, or will there be these four? Or will there ever be a deal that's good again? Nope. Deals always find you. 1031 exchanges always happen, right? And every time I've sold, it's led to brighter and better things every time. So I don't sweat the details anymore on those. When I'm ready to sell, when the return on equity, when the property is worth 2.5x, and all of my sales, I've never sold anything less than 2x multiple. Wow. Everything I've sold has been double or triple in some cases. And so at that point, it becomes like, okay, it's obviously cash flowing. And there is cash flow in multifamily. That's another myth, right, that you see with these syndicators and a lot of these deals. When you buy with that model, there is no cash flow. It's a flip. So a multifamily syndicator is just a flipper. And they'll admit, they'll be the first to admit that there's no shame in that, but they're a flipper. And I've never been a flipper. I wasn't a flipper in single family. I never understood or respected that model. And I'm not a flipper in multifamily. Although I respect it more in multifamily because there's a lot more to go around.
Right. That's for sure. That's for sure. Serge, this has been fascinating. I love what you're doing. I love your philosophy as it surrounds that deals will always find you, that, you know, when it's time to sell, it's time to sell. I think that's something that's refreshing. It's like, oh, well, hey, you know what? There's always gonna be more stuff on the table. And I also love love just your perspective from, you know, how you're not beholden to other syndicators or not syndicators, other limited partners. So when you see a unique deal that makes sense, that requires you to put your balance sheet on the line, you can do it. And you can take down some weird assets. And that is your competitive advantage, is that others might be completely unbankable and or they just can't get their investors to see what they see as the opportunity. But for you, you call yourself and you say, hey, self, do you like this? Yes. So you guys go and do it. And it's pretty simple, right?
Well, think about the constraints, right? And again, this is another lesson I learned doing the syndication. The syndication, the knowledge was so valuable. So what I learned was, at the time, I was preaching the Tucson market, right? That this was 2015 and Phoenix had bounced back and prices were getting high and Tucson was just so undervalued. And I was there, right? I was living in Metro Phoenix. I saw what was going on. But we couldn't invest because the investors aren't on board on Tucson yet. The Milken report ranks Tucson number 40 and not in the top five, you know? And I'm saying, well, the Milken report is a year behind. Right. Listen to me. I'm here. I see it. I see the job growth. I see the companies coming. I see the rent growth. I see that there's a ton of assets that haven't been renovated. No, we couldn't do two. The investors don't like Tucson. The investors don't like secondary markets. The lenders don't want to do this kind of asset that's got master metered, for example. Or, you know, so you have all these constraints. And I'm sitting here saying, why do I want the same constraints that everybody else that's looking for the same assets wants, right? And that's why we couldn't do a deal, because nothing would underwrite. Everything was $1 million off or $500,000 off, right? Because other investors were just like, you know, well, I'm underwriting this with 1% more rent growth or a little bit less economic loss. I can make it work. We were trying to be conservative. And with all these constraints, we missed all these deals. Right. And then I talk to this specific company and syndicator, and like, oh man, you were right on Tucson. We should have done it. All those deals we looked at, we should have done this. We should have done that. And I'm like, yeah, that's why I'm not syndicating anymore. I don't want constraints.
Right. Right. Bingo.
Some of the best assets I've ever bought. Right. I'm talking, I mean, when you exit, you calculate the IRR. I mean, you wouldn't even believe seeing some of these numbers. I mean, the numbers are insane. And because I took the risk. I took the risk. It wasn't for free. It was because I saw the risk, I mitigated it, and I executed it. And 99% wouldn't have been able to take that risk. And so that market is thriving. There's more deals than I can do in that market, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas I go to traditional multifamily, good luck. good luck. Good luck going to the highest and best 30 offers, broker manipulation, or trying to go off market. You know, I've done off market deals and I've purchased 300 multifamily units this year, traditional multifamily, traditional 1980s B2C class. I've purchased those all off market. You can still get them 10x harder than a non-traditional deal that that you're not competing against. 10 times harder, harder to make money, harder for the pro is that the processes for management are in place. So if you have a good property manager, you send them there, you know, I'll make one visit, I'll plan out my CapEx, and I won't need to be there again for probably the entirety of the hold. Right. I have properties that I visited twice that I ended up cashing out $6 million on, for example. And I literally visited it twice, you know, and it's funny talking to my wife. Hey, you know, I got this other deal. And now she's gauging deals, not on the exit, but on how much time it's going to take for me. Mm. Right. We're living in the northern mountains. So we're about an hour from Metro Phoenix. It's like, oh, is this deal going to require you to drive down? And I'm like, got 5 million meat on the bone. So what if I got to drive down twice?
Right, right.
Twice, you know, like, you know, so you get lazy, you know, you get lazy, but it's fun. It's fun. I have no complaints. Just truly, truly blessed.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I've thoroughly enjoyed this and enjoyed learning about your business and how you guys function. Let's jump here into the final four if we can. The first question is this. What is the first question? Oh, what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Get started. Get started and be careful who you listen to, right? There's a lot of people espousing themselves as market professionals that haven't done a deal,
right?
And a market professional in Florida isn't a market professional in Texas, right? So be careful who you listen to, be careful who mentors you, right? But at the same time, get a deal done, get a deal done. Watch on the side. If you're on the sidelines, watch. And prepare as if the next deal is about to hit you. And probably my best advice, right, is really to become, how should I put this? Become a farmer instead of a hunter, right? I think I've heard somebody say that before, right? But real estate is a relationship business. And anybody that tells you otherwise is bullshitting you, right? If, and I don't care if it's single family or multifamily, if you burn people, you're not getting deals again.
Right.
Right. So become a farmer before you reap the benefits, before you reap the fruits, right? Create your broker relationships. Be nice to everybody. Find investors that are doing what you want to do and help those people, right? And then when the deal does present itself, you'll be ready rather than being the guy that saving money. Oh, now I have money. Now I need to find a deal. And you're hunting for the deal. You're not finding a deal.
Right.
You're not coming to Arizona and competing with some of these guys that have been doing deals and building broker relationships for 100 unit multifamily. And I don't care if you got 5 million in the bank. You're not getting a deal.
Right.
You know, you're not getting a decent deal. Right. You're going to be in highest and best. They're going to use you as a baseline to bring the real buyer up. Right. And you're going to be meat for 5 years until you've built those relationships. And so start and do it right the first time from the beginning.
Right.
A lot of value.
Yeah, I love that. Be a farmer, not a hunter. That's absolutely critical advice. Question number two is this. When it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
Oh, man, right here. Let me show you something. Every single day, last guy in the United States that actually reads the newspaper cover to cover, my family laughs at me. My kids laugh at me. That's my secret sauce. I know what's coming down the pipeline. I'll find a tiny article in maybe a paragraph. And it's going to have an enormous impact on my business. And I'm going to know in advance and I'm going to be prepared for it. Right. And I've been doing it since I was a kid. That's my secret sauce, is knowing everything that's going on around me. If you're blind to that, real estate's not for you, because real estate is a function of everything that's in that paper every day.
Right. Right. Absolutely. That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Oh, my God. You know, I could think of a lot of things, but they all come back to selfishness. You know, at the end of the day, you know, I could say I'm providing good quality housing and all that fun stuff. But if you're doing something that's making you money and making you rich, you know, how are you making the world a better place? At the end of the day, you can say you're a job creator, like the Republicans like to say, but are you really a job creator when you buy a multifamily that already had five jobs and you're figuring out how to do it with four? right? We're big on recycling. We're big on the environment, right? We'll go out of our way to recycle ourselves since the change. But even that, I can't take credit for. That's all my wife. So I'm lacking in that department. Let's put it that way.
Not necessarily. And this is, if that's, we can cut all this out too, if you want. It's, it's just the questions we ask. And I'm sure there are ways you're giving that you aren't coming right to the top of your head. But I get it. In the end, you're right. In the end, if we're giving money, it makes us feel better. If we're providing housing, we're still making money. I mean, I get it. So no worries. The last question is this. Serge, if we're listening, want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
You can find me on Bigger Pockets. Haven't contributed in a while, but I'm there. Serge S. You could find me on LinkedIn. There's a number of ways to find me. If you need me, reach out. Every one of these podcasts usually leads to one or two interesting relationships, phone calls, relationships. I've had people call me and talk about so many different things. And I love talking real estate. So reach out.
Awesome. Serge, thanks so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.